The refugee crisis in Venezuela is now creating an economic burden for its neighbor, Colombia. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans are fleeing their country's regime, searching for jobs, medicine, and hope. But now Colombians are beginning to resent those refugees, and both countries will soon have presidential elections. We'll look at how that could play out. Moisha Mena is one of the largest landowners and real estate developers in Miami-Dade. He thinks Miami has a lot of room for growth.
Miami really, it's not a place where it can really enhance talent, and it's boring at the end of the day.
And a group of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas students are performing in the controversial show Spring Awakening. We'll hear from some of the show's crew and how poignant that production has become for the students. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Venezuela's catastrophic economic collapse has created an equally awful humanitarian crisis. Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans are fleeing their country, and many are languishing just across the border in Colombia, where international aid groups say there's now a full-blown refugee emergency at a similar scale as Syria's. We recently spoke with WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett, who's in Cúcuta, Colombia this week, and we asked him why this small town has become the epicenter of the refugee crisis.
Well, it's the most popular crossing between Venezuela and Colombia. There is a bridge over the Táchira River that separates Venezuela and Colombia here from the city of San Cristobal on the Venezuelan side over here to Cúcuta. So it's become really the valve through which Venezuelans are escaping the economic collapse in Venezuela to come in to Colombia to try to find jobs, food, medicine, all the things that they no longer can find in Venezuela. So Cúcuta has become, as it were, the receptacle for the lion's share of Venezuelans taking refuge into Colombia. And so every day, every morning at dawn, as soon as that bridge opens, it's called the Simón Bolívar International Bridge, as soon as that bridge opens, you see tens of thousands of Venezuelans just in an endless stream coming across into Cúcuta. Officials estimate that anywhere between 20 to 30,000 Venezuelans each day are coming over, and as many as a quarter of them decide to stay. So you've got about 5,000 Venezuelans coming into Cúcuta every day, not just to, you know, find day labor or some food and medicine, but to stay here, to try to make new lives here. And that's putting an awful strain on this city.
Yeah, and if that's how many you're seeing every day, I mean, how many Venezuelan migrants have taken refuge there in the past year then?
In the past year, you've seen more than 500,000 Venezuelans come into Colombia to try to start new lives here, whether it's in Cúcuta or further into the country in Bogota or other cities. Many of them, after a while, decide to move on to other countries like Ecuador and Peru. But the lion's share stay in Colombia, and the lion's share of those who stay in Colombia are literally refugees now here in this border town of Cúcuta.
Have you been able to speak with any of the refugees on the ground?
Yes, I was there at dawn this morning speaking to many of them as they came over. I spoke to a 30-year-old industrial engineer from the industrial town of Valencia near Caracas. He is no longer able to feed his wife and his 8-month-old baby boy. And so he's come over to Cúcuta where he's hoping to find a relative or two who can put him up and help him find some work here so that he can send money back to his family there in Valencia. I mean, one of the ironies of his case, his name was Alvaro, was that his parents, before he was born, were refugees from the Colombian Civil War who went to Valencia when they were younger to seek refuge themselves. Now he's seeking refuge as their son, coming in to Colombia. I also spoke to a teacher from Venezuela named Elsa Sanguino. And she expressed what most Venezuelans are feeling as they make this awful trek over to Colombia, as you'll hear from this clip.
It's humiliating for Venezuelan people to come here in these conditions, you know. It's very sad. It's desperate. It's very upsetting because the living conditions in Venezuela, I mean, for a mother to not to be able to buy milk or diapers, because they don't have the money, or even if they have the money, they cannot find them. I have no words for that.
Tim, are they telling stories we haven't heard yet in the media coverage of this crisis? Are we hearing anything new?
Well, what's new is that the United Nations is getting closer to deciding that these Venezuelans who are coming into Colombia and other countries in South America should be formally designated as refugees. And if that were to happen, it would help to unlock a lot more funds from the international community to help these refugees. It's hard to call them anything but refugees. When I was watching them come over this morning, the first thing that these Venezuelans see and hear as soon as they cross over into Cucuta is men handing them leaflets to show them where they can go sell their jewelry, for example. Or one of the more unpleasant things you hear is men calling out saying they'll buy the women's hair to make wigs. These are the kinds of things that Venezuelans are confronting as they come over here because they do need the money that badly. So yes, it's hard to look at these people as anything but refugees. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees is hoping to raise almost $50 million for the Venezuelans here in Colombia and elsewhere in South America. So far, they've only been able to raise about 6 or 7% of that. So I think there is a need amongst the media and other organizations to get the word out to countries like the U.S. and the rest of the international community that there is a real necessity here in terms of unlocking international funds for these people pouring out of Venezuela here.
They're going to Colombia because they hope to find food and medical care and jobs that they need. So are they actually finding that stuff, or are they just becoming a new homeless population?
Unfortunately, as this crisis goes on, they are becoming more of a homeless population. You see a lot of Venezuelans in the streets, as I said before, even people who were professionals back in Venezuela, reduced to doing things like selling bags of limes on the street, or unfortunately, a lot of women having to resort to prostitution. When they run out of hair to sell for wigs and things of that nature. So you are seeing a sort of a destitute and often homeless population here. There are no real refugee camps that you would see, for example, out of Syria. But you do have a lot of Catholic missions and organizations like that that have been taking these people in to help feed them. But there really is no sort of formal shelter in many ways for these people. So yes, you are seeing a rather destitute homeless population emerge.
And as you said, they leave there. Sometimes they go into the bigger cities. How is Colombia's economy handling this massive migration?
It's putting quite a strain on Colombia's economy, especially in border towns like this. You have to remember that Cúcuta is not a very large city. It's not a very industrial city. And what industry it has depended in large part on Venezuela's economic health. For example, as I was coming back from the Simón Bolívar Bridge this morning, my taxi driver pointed out a factory that used to employ 300 people making aluminum products, which it would sell to companies in Venezuela. But with Venezuela's economic collapse, that factory is close to being shut down, he said. And it just shows you how Venezuela's economic collapse has affected the economy over here in Colombia. But it's also these towns like Cúcuta then, as they're going under their own economic problems, are having to receive these tens of thousands of Venezuelans. It's just an awful cocktail of factors for Colombia to deal with. And you're seeing a lot of Colombians beginning to feel resentful. One Colombian in Miami, for example, told me to be ready to face Colombians feeling, in many ways, the same sort of anti-immigration sentiment that we saw amongst a lot of American voters in the 2016 presidential election. And I should remind you that later this month, we're going to be having a presidential election here in Colombia.
Interesting that you say there's a growing resentment because, as you also mentioned, there's a little bit of deja vu here. This 15, 20 years ago, you had a lot of people fleeing Colombia to go to Venezuela.
Exactly. And that's why you have such a mixed feeling here. There's a lot of guilt, I think, also amongst people who are feeling the resentment toward all these Venezuelan migrants because they realize that a generation ago, Venezuela very charitably and generously received many, many thousands of Colombian refugees who were fleeing the civil war that just ended after a half a century. They were also fleeing their own poverty. When I was living in Venezuela in Caracas in the 1980s, it was very common to see Colombian migrants and refugees looking for jobs. So the tables have turned quite a bit. It's a 180-degree situation. And so, yes, you do see a lot of mixed feelings on the part of Colombians as they're trying to deal with this influx of Venezuelans.
All right. As you mentioned, there is an election coming up. Actually, there are two. Venezuela's got its election. Colombia has a presidential election. How is that going to impact the refugee crisis? And really, how is this crisis impacting the elections?
Well, let's start with the Venezuelan election, if you can call it that, on May 20th. Most of the international community has already decided it's not going to accept the results because the election has been so severely rigged in favor of socialist president Nicolas Maduro. And I think if there is enough outcry about that sort of thing on May 20th, you could see a lot more international pressure on Maduro to accept international aid. I mean, really, one of the, people sort of refer to what Maduro is doing in terms of rejecting international aid for Venezuelans as sort of criminal. And it's one of the big reasons Venezuelans are having to resort to fleeing the country and coming to countries like Colombia, because Maduro is in such denial about how he and his socialist regime have absolutely wrecked the Venezuelan economy that they will not accept aid from countries like the United States or the European Union. And that has only exacerbated the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. So the election, if there's enough of an outcry about the fraud of this election and against the socialist regime, it could put more pressure on that regime to start accepting international aid and maybe help improve this refugee situation a little bit. Now, I think the real impact will be on the May 27th Colombian presidential election. The conservative candidate there, Iván Duque, has jumped ahead in the polls in large part because of that growing wariness about the strain that Venezuelan immigrants are putting on the country, but also because these Venezuelan migrants are telling Colombians about how awful the socialists have made the economic situation and the humanitarian situation in Venezuela. And so that's creating sort of a conservative backlash in Colombia, which is also helping the conservative candidate. Let me just add that as bad as things were last year, this year, officials are estimating that almost 2 million Venezuelans could leave Venezuela. Again, the lion's share of them coming to Colombia. So in total, at the end of this year, you could have as many as 3 million Venezuelans having left Venezuela. That represents a tenth of the country's population, many of them educated. So you've got a brain drain to take into account as well. It takes most countries a generation or two to recover from that kind of exodus.
And again, that was WLRN reporter Tim Padgett speaking with us from Cúcuta, Colombia, about the wave of Venezuelan immigrants coming into the country. Well, still to come, we spoke with one of the largest landowners in Miami-Dade. What does he think of the city? And what are his plans for Wynwood? That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, billionaire real estate investor Moishe Mana has grand ambitions for Miami. He owns dozens of acres of land in Wynwood that he's proposing for a special area plan. It would include new housing, artist galleries, and commercial space that would act as the intersection between Chinese and Latin American businesses. Mana also owns properties along Flagler Street. He envisions shared tech spaces that attract Silicon Valley's best and also retains talent here. His proposals face controversy over concerns of gentrification and the potential for more high-rises. He joined us in our studios last week, and I began by asking him about his vision for Wynwood when he arrived 9 years ago.
I've been going in and out Miami for many, many years, so Miami is not new for me. What I saw in Wynwood and what I saw in Miami is not much different, you know, because Miami really, at the end of the day, me coming from New York and without really being arrogant and showing off and so forth, Miami's really needs, like a lot of culture. It lacks a lot of diversity of businesses, opportunities. And Miami, for the most part, is really, it has a great name in the world, very diversified community. But Miami really still doesn't, it's not a place where it can really enhance talent or keep the talent in here And it's boring at the end of the day, you know, when you come in and out. It's really boring comparing to other cities, you know. So that's why it's very hard to keep people stay here long term, you know.
When you do you remember the first time you arrived, at, you went to Wynwood?
Yes.
What did you think of that area?
Okay. Wynwood really, because you have to understand where I'm coming from and my history and what I've done in my life, you know, to understand what I saw in Wynwood. But I saw a place where I can really execute my ideas, a place where I can really create a change in Miami. It was a big area, cheap area. I could afford it at the time, where it's located. And early on, when I got into Miami, into Wynwood, I declared that Wynwood is going to be the cultural hub of Miami that Miami needs so much, you know. And since then, yes, Miami is Wynwood is becoming the cultural hub of Miami, and I'm hoping to bring more, you know, to bring more of everything that the city needs into Wynwood.
After 10 years, you've seen all these changes. You've been part of those changes to Wynwood. What is it missing?
Well, you have to, again, Wynwood is not operating in a vacuum, and Wynwood is part of Miami. And in order to change Miami around, I mean, you need a catalyst, and Wynwood is a catalyst, you know, and Wynwood just going to be a beginning of the entire Miami, because Miami doesn't have fashion industry, so I have to bring the fashion, but you got to start it somewhere. Miami needs more entertainment, and entertainment not just clubs, because we have plenty of them, but in terms of creating comedy club, theater, bring the talent, keep the talent in here. It needs diversified businesses that related to that enhancing culture, which is needed. But I saw everything, you know, in terms of art, in terms of fashion, if anything, this is a place where you can start building the area, the, you know, the whole, you know, the, this is where the beginning of, it's not that Miami was totally a desert, but Miami needed a place where everybody going to meet and everybody going to start something from where, and you know.
And Wynwood is that place.
And Wynwood is the place, definitely.
Now, you have 30 acres of land in Wynwood designated for a major redevelopment project. What can you tell us about the special area plan?
Okay, first of all, it's, I think it's totally about 45 acres. In Wynwood, when I came here, I had two projects in mind, and I said that I'm going to change it, you know. So the one that we needed, the cultural hub, and we're going to build the Mana Contemporary that we built in Jersey, where artists create, sell, work. Miami doesn't have art trading except Art Basel. So also bringing the trade of the arts and bringing the artists to work here and bringing the collectors to come and buy from here. And I'm going back to the issue of, again, for the culture, you know. In Miami, I saw it as a link, as a bridge that connects South America and America in terms of cultural hub. Because South America is overlooked. The art is overlooked, the fashion is overlooked, everything's overlooked by American. To extend, it's a bit arrogant also, you know. And I thought that the food, the South American culture, Miami is really a good place where it can connect. It can be the link to connect South America to America and get America to be more familiar with South America and the culture and what South America can offer to America.
And for so many years, though, people thought of Miami and South Florida as the gateway to Latin America. But you're saying we haven't done enough of that.
It's definitely the gateway. This is the whole point. It's the gateway. But it still didn't do what it's supposed to be doing, connecting on a different level, you know. And it's connecting South America on a different level.
Your special area plan, is this going to be where that begins and bringing it all together?
Okay, let's go back into, we're talking about the culture part of it. But there was another project, me going to China, working in China, have business in China. There's another project that always was in my mind since 2004, 2005, that I think that, and I was thinking where to put it. And I thought this project can really make, again, the difference in the business aspect of it. And going to South America, to China, I totally understood that we are going global. There's no questions about it. Many South Americans coming there to buy a container or two containers and then go back. Trading used to be physical, then it went all digital. But then I figured we need a physical place where the people who are buying a container or two, they're going to come to, because they're not going to be able to buy it off on the internet. If they want to buy a container full of plates, they're not going to buy it over the internet. They need to go to China, waste 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And they come here, maybe they get it, maybe they don't get it. So I thought that we have to build an ecosystem where we're going to have showrooms, representation of so many Chinese manufacturers, connecting South America businesses in one hub. So I call it a global trade hub to facilitate all trade between the Far East, South America, and America. So that's why I kept pushing for more zoning, more density, because in our project, we don't have one residential project in it, because I believe in totally bringing the commerce, bringing the business. Later on, we could do the residential. So our project is different in a way where we're not putting the emphasis on the residential. We're putting the emphasis on the business. And I always tell people, there's a limit how many coffee shops we can have and how many restaurants we can have and how many galleries we can have, but we need the business to back it up. So the idea is to bring the future corporate headquarters of China to be in Miami.
And that's what this SAP is, the special area, is to bring the Chinese, the Latin American businesses together.
Into one ecosystem, exactly. Into one ecosystem where they collaborate and can work together. So I call it physical for the digital.
I wanted to ask you, it's talking about trying to build that connection with China and Latin America, bringing them together
through Miami.
Here. Yes.
Through Miami.
Through Miami. What's your concern about the tariffs that have been levied on Chinese businesses?
Okay, again, we're talking about a demagogue. I don't believe he believes in what he says. I don't believe this is the way to do it. We're part of a global community and not a global jungle. And there is ways of negotiating and ways of doing things. And again, he's talking about coal business when we need to do trades, when we need to do innovations, when you need to do when you do banking, when you need to do, we used to head the world in all kind of ways, in terms of trade, innovations, climate, safety of the world. To talk about, doing this and doing this is just to satisfy some of his voters, and I don't think it's a good message for the world. It's not a good message for America.
How is it affecting your plan, though? How is it affecting your ability to build that relationship with China?
Of course, first thing the Chinese do when we talk about America and we tell them how stable America, they laugh, and they call our president account names. Other people, Chinese a little bit more reserved, and they would not do it direct to the face, but they would laugh, okay? Some people also call names, but they think it's crazy, because when we try to tell them America is a stable place to do business, it's a place, we got the dollar, we got, we got the legal that you can come and do it here. Now they got a new alternative, Panama. And Panama is getting into the footing where America was supposed to be doing. And I was on a trip with President of Panama, and Panama giving all the incentives for the Chinese to come and build this ecosystem in Panama.
So this is hurting your ability to get any contracts or any kind.
No questions, no but if. There is a lot of, we're not sure when you want to build a headquarter, when you're going to put it. They're not sure if they're going to come in and out. They're going to be able to come in and out. This is another big question. When I lay out the whole vision, are you sure we're going to be able to come in? The same thing with South America when they want to invest here. Can we come here? You cannot come here.
Let me push back just a little bit on this.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, that China in any way should be penalized for intellectual property theft? mostly of American businesses. I mean, what, how do you deal with that?
Okay, definitely we should find ways how to get China to stop it, okay? Today, they're stealing our intellectual properties. Tomorrow, we're going to steal their intellectual properties. And I think what China is really doing today, you have to understand where China is coming from, and I'm not trying to be a lawyer for China. Where China is coming from, it came from 50 years of nothing. You know, nothing. Then they start really building their business and building their countries, you know. Just to tell you, no, just to let you know, in the 1800s, China was, the Far East was more rich than America. It was the center of trades of the world, you know. So now they come up from 50 years of nothing. And in order to get into this community, it's taken them time to integrate into the community. They did not care in the past for global warming. Now they're heading the global warming. They didn't care many issues. They didn't care for other countries. And you see them now going invest in other countries, writing off debts to other countries. And they're doing stuff that America was doing in the beginning of the century and what made America great. So definitely there is ways to go back to China and explain and argue. I don't think the Chinese going to write it off because we are both connected one with each other. And to start trade wars, any kind of war, I don't think it serves our purpose.
Let me finish up on this again, looking at what you're doing in Wynwood and again bringing China and Latin America together. There's a textile convention coming up in late May at the Mano Wynwood Center. So that's an example, perhaps. How are you bringing Latin America and China together in that? What's that going to be about?
This is going to be representing manufacturers, apparel manufacturers in Miami for North America and South America in one place. But we have it in terms of agriculture plant. We have another one for Qingdao, a big one. So this is, again, you know, because there is no questions the Chinese are going to be opening headquarters in the Western Hemisphere. The question, where they're going to do it? They're going to Panama. They're going to do it in some of the South American countries, Mexico. Or they're going to do it in New York, or they do it in Texas. I want to catch them today to do it in Miami today.
Again, I'm speaking with Moesha Mana, a major real estate developer here in South Florida. He has a major project planned in Wynwood and along Flagler Street, as we've been discussing, looking again to create international connections and to strengthen Miami's position in the Western Hemisphere, not just with Latin America, as he said, also with China. One of the things, too, that you mentioned it just briefly earlier, but I read this about you, is that you talked about the talent. So we don't have the talent here, or we can't keep the talent here, and this is a problem for for the region. Where do you start? How do you invite the talent, that talent in tech, that talent in in business to South Florida, and the ones that we have, how do you convince them to stay? What does that take?
Okay, so we have an issue here of people finishing school, young kids finishing school and living, Florida. Then we went to get high-tech companies, big ones. They said there's no talent. So now what we need, and in a funny way, I said this is not a question of the chicken or the egg, what comes first, okay? This is a simple question. Just build the farm for the chicken that be able to hatch eggs. Who cares what comes first? So we need to, and this is something that usually I've seen in China and I've seen in other countries, that they really, this is government project. It should be fine. It should be not totally financed, helped, incentivized. We need to keep the people here, the young people here. And how you do that? By building affordable workforce housing. Miami got a big problem in Miami for years. The condos, they sell it to the South American, they sell it to people who want vacations. They come, they keep it locked, or they rent it a little bit, but it's not really geared to keep the young people. So this is where it's a really crucial to keep, you know, to build the workforce housing, micro units.
Now, but things are getting better though. I mean, Miami, Fort Lauderdale was recently listed as the best place for startups recently. So we are making progress, right?
Definitely we do.
Okay. I wanted to try to come back and ask you, though, about the other projects that you're working on Flagler Street, and just wanted to know a little bit about what you have plans for that.
Okay, again, you know, this is something that I think in terms of what change is going to bring to, you know, to Miami. So what I'm looking to do, I build community with the community that based on high tech and put them into one place, one ecosystem, you know, and provide them with housing, provide them with restaurants, food, provide them with amenities that they can collaborate.
And there'll be affordable housing?
It will be affordable, but it's coming back again to what we are doing as an organization, and it's something we are really representing to, we're going to be presenting our project to the world, and it's a different kind of economy. It's a different kind of economy. It's a different kind of approach to real estate. It's a different way to approach to business. Okay, we are building the Mana Common, sharing space and sharing sense, and it's about keeping the community within. So Flagler Street, I believe, you know, and I said, but in a very unique way, what we can really do in Miami. I believe that we can really build within Flagler Street the Silicon Valley of South America, because South America need a lot of help. And I see, and I've seen many technology companies that they really have a lot of energy, a lot of you know, technologies, but they really need to drive it to the second and third and fourth stage. And many of them find themselves in San Francisco, and they get overlooked because, it's South America, it's not interesting. So if we can really put emphasis here on South American technology and connecting 700 million people to our economy and to the world economy, I think this is going to be a big, this will be a big achievement if I can get it done.
Let me ask you just as we finish up here, again, coming back to your projects here in Miami, is there a timeline that you're following on when those will be done?
Okay, I have my timeline, I have the world timeline, okay? So, you know, I try to get started, but this project, I said, you know, when what we're doing in Wynwood, what we're doing in, you know, Miami, it's like you're asking Walt Disney, you have any timetables to finish your cartoon, you know, animation business. I believe it's going to go to many, many other areas, and this includes collaborating the schools, collaborating the universities throughout the world, collaboration of communities throughout the world. It has so many, so many levels and so many layers that we will keep adding, peeling, connecting. This project is just the beginning of a change of Miami.
And what's
the next chapter?
Your relationship right now with the government, local governments in your projects, what's that been like?
They are big supporters, but again, you know, I'm very frustrated because everything, we cannot do that. They're going out of the way within the limits. And Miami has issues also as far as time of permits, work permits, length of holding you back. And it's not easy to do development, not easy to, and comparing to New York, comparing what we do over there. They go out of the way to help me, I must tell you. But they keep telling me it's not within what we could do. And it's very frustrating. But the fact that they really want to help me, this is planning. I mean, the fact that they really have the willingness and the, you know, and the desire to help. Actually, we just came back from a trip with 50 officials of Miami, including Mayor Jimenez, the head of transportation, the head of the director of the ports, airports. And they did a trip to the Far East, but we were able to organize for them agreements with Qingdao before they came there. This is our initiative's organization and our connection in Qingdao. And Qingdao is a 10 million people city with a 100 million province. It's industrial province. You know, it's industrial province. It has the fourth largest port in the world. And we were able to prearrange a collaboration with Qingdao. We had some old sister city agreement that we took it and we brushed it and we brought it back to the table. It was signed, I think, 10 years ago. And then we signed collaboration port and airports, tourist exchange. And definitely now, today, the businesses in Qingdao, they know, because in China, it's a bit different than here. Everything the government has to tell you, it's okay to do. So the government there told him, Qingdao, it's okay to go and do in Miami. It's okay to go to Miami and do business.
Let me finish with this. Going back to the idea of what is your purpose, what do you think is your purpose here in Miami?
If I can really make the difference in Miami and bring other, you know, bring industries and make Miami to become like Hong Kong of the Far East, I know that we as an organization, we cannot accomplish it, but we can start it. So this is the beginning of change, of recognizing Miami for where it's sitting and the capability of Miami, that it can really be, I totally believe this can be a global trade hub and can facilitate all trades for the Western Hemisphere. And this is something, if I can achieve this, this would be, I'm sure that Henry Flagler will say thank you, Moshe.
And again, that was billionaire real estate investor Moshe Mana talking about his thoughts, one, what Miami is and could be, and also his plans for his development project in Wynwood. Well, still to come, the Black Box Theater in Boca is doing a production of Spring Awakening with a few students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas. We'll have that story coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. As many students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas continue their political activism after the Parkland shooting, a few have found an artistic space for their passion, theater. Over the past couple of months, three of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas students have been involved in the Black Box Theater's production of Spring Awakening. The play is from 1891, but its themes couldn't be more contemporary and relevant. Teenagers dealing with their sexuality, depression, and violence. Christine Barclay is the owner and artistic director of Barclay Performing Arts, as well as the director of this production. Christine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Also, Lee Torelli plays Dea in the show and is a returning company member. Lee, did I say that right?
You said Taya right, yeah.
Taya, perfect, okay. Also, Giorgio Garcia plays Georg.
Yes.
But
yes.
Also is an understudy to the lead, which is...
Melchior.
Melchior, thank
Melchior
you.
Melchior Gabor.
There you go, played by Parkland activist Cameron Caskey. By the way, we did request to speak with Marjory Stoneman Douglas students, Cameron Caskey, Alfonso Calderon, and Sawyer Garrity, but they couldn't join us. They are in the midst of standardized testing this week. They are still students, by the way. All right, Christine, let's start with you. I mean, the company was working on Spring Awakening weeks before the Parkland shooting. Why did you originally choose this show, though?
We had had a couple conversations with my students in general when I was starting the company, because it's a young startup company.
It's a couple
we opened
years,
it,
right?
Yeah, 2016, January 2016. And so I kind of threw the net out there and asked which shows they were interested in doing. And they picked all the edgy shows, which was interesting to me. Heather's the musical, Spring Awakening, Rent. And it kind of opened up the conversation to me about, you know, why it was that the kids were also wanting to do shows that dealt with those subject matters. You know, why not doing the more fluffy, you know, Hairsprays or Hello Dollies or, you know, but that wasn't what they wanted. They wanted the edgy stuff. And it was like, why that? Why is it because you can't talk about it anywhere? Is it because your schools won't do it? Is it because this is the only outlet you have to sort of do those sorts of things, have those discussions, have the conversation about what sex might feel like, what it's like to feel violent thoughts towards yourself, towards other people, and have a platform to discuss it? And by the time they kept harassing me about doing those shows, I finally threw my hands in the air and said, you know what, the beauty of not being in a school, being a private company, is that I can do those shows.
Was there ever a moment where you were thinking, no, we can't do that one?
You know, there wasn't a moment that I said I couldn't. It was more like the timeline. Do I want to open my company and within the first 2 years? I mean, we did Heather's a year ago and we did Spring Awakening a year later. Do I want to be identified as the company that just goes for the edgy shows? But at the end of the day, our company, as you see on Gio's shirt right now, our slogan is Find Your Voice, Sing Your Song. And it's a platform for kids to express themselves and not just to create a little Broadway. It's a place for them to find a comfort.
And one of the challenges, as you know, with theater companies is you need the audience.
Yes.
You need to have that audience there. And audiences in general tend to go for the fluffy, fun stuff.
Well, yeah, and especially in Boca.
You have to. So you have to mix it. Sometimes you have to do those popular ones.
Right.
So you could do the edgy ones, but you decided no.
Well, we balanced. We did Spring Awakening for our advanced teens and college program. And then we're still simultaneously rehearsing Legally Blonde, which is going up 2 weeks later, and that's with our middle school, high school group. So if you were a kid or a family that wasn't ready for that kind of material, we had something else for you. We had Legally Blonde. But if you didn't want to think pink, it's Spring Awakening.
After the shooting, though, I mean, were you thinking, rethinking this show? What was going on?
Honestly, I wasn't rethinking the show because I felt that what a better time to have the open discussion. I was worried that maybe the kids were going to feel that they weren't going to be emotionally able to handle it. The hard thing was that 5 days after the shooting, I gave birth to my baby. And so I only was able to take 2 weeks off of maternity leave in order to be able to get back to rehearsal because the people I had left, my company managers in charge of those 2 weeks, it was like a ship on uncharted waters because everyone was missing rehearsals or emotionally conflicted, or it was such a struggle for them to do that without me there to sort of be at the helm. And so here I was dealing with all these students who I kind of treat like my teenage adopted kids going through hell. And I'm trying to enjoy the other spectrum of life, which is a beautiful newborn baby. And it was a wild ride.
By the way, congratulations on
Thanks.
That. All right. So Lee and Giorgio, let me ask you this. I mean, what's special about the show? How do you describe it to anybody who's never seen it before? Lee?
Sorry, I'm getting over a cold. But I would consider the show to be such a roller coaster of a show because it touches on, like you said, it touches on modern day subjects. It like abuse, sexuality, teenage pregnancy, abortion, molestation and rape as well, and suicide. I mean,
gun violence.
Yeah. Gun violence. But it's an intense show.
Did anything change? What changed, maybe, is a better question. After the shooting, you're dealing with this very heavy show and all of these topics, but after the shooting, what was going on at that point?
Well, I mean, of course, everyone obviously had a very different perspective of the show now, you know, where they could unfortunately now relate to certain things. Like, I personally, I didn't go to Stoneman, but our cast, we're all a big family. So for the people who were affected, we were doing our best to be like, hey, if you need anything, if you need someone to talk to, if you just need anything, we're here for you. And I really need you to know that.
Giorgio, yeah, I'm just curious your thoughts on, you know, after that happened. And then, of course, you know, you've got your leader has to step out because she's giving birth. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what was going on around that time? How did you guys all bring it back together?
Well, at first it was kind of difficult because we were rehearsing without those Stoneman kids. You know, they were all taking care of themselves and, you know, getting over something huge. So it was understandable. But we were rehearsing with a lesser cast, and it was very difficult to get back into it just because we all wanted to be there for them and they were all doing their own things and just trying to get back into their normal lifestyles. And it took a while, but we're still trying to get the show together and it's looking good. And we're all getting where we need to be and we're all there for each other and supporting each other. So,
and again, that show that's coming up, it's Spring Awakening. It's, again, a very controversial show, a show from the 19th century. But again, the themes hit on so much that young people go through today. And that, again, is part of the Boca Black Box Theater. The artistic director, of course, Christine Barclay, is of Barclay Performing Arts. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and learn a little bit more about the show. If you haven't seen it before, we're going to learn more about the characters and, again, where you could see it. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, we're talking about a new show coming to the Boca Black Box Theater. It's the show Spring Awakening, a very controversial show, hits on a lot of dark, deep themes for young people. We're talking with Christine Barclay, owner and artistic director of Barclay Performing Arts, as well as the director of this production. Lee Torelli is one of the cast, and Giorgio Garcia, also one of the cast. Lee, let's talk about your character,
yes.
Taya.
Yes.
All right.
That's right. You got it.
Tell me, who is Taya?
Taya is one of the more, what I describe her. She has a very relaxed life for the most part. She doesn't have, like, as far as I know,
she's more naive, I would say,
yeah,
than the other.
Yeah.
She hasn't been through the darkness as much as kind of what we were discussing with Lee.
It's nothing like Marta, who at home gets beat by her father as well as, for all we know, raped by her father as well. And her sister suffered through the same thing, but they kicked her out and she lives on the streets now, you know? And like, Taya is kind of like me. She's like very caring, very emotional. And like when she hears that Marta has been beaten, she tries to lighten the mood and like, hey, my Uncle Klaus says that if you don't discipline your child, you don't care. And Marta's like, is that right now?
Yeah, it's like Taya's still very much at the mercy of her parents.
Yeah.
And Giorgio, what about you? You play Georg.
Georg, yes. And if I'm going to be completely honest, Georg is like the comic relief-ish of
Giorgio.
The show. It's me.
It's you.
He's okay. Who I am, yeah. No, but he's like madly in love with his piano teacher, and there's a scene in the show where he like has like a fantasy with her. It's interesting.
And you're the understudy
yes.
for the lead.
I'm the understudy for Melchior. Yes.
What's that like when you're preparing for one role, but you've got to be ready for another?
Well, I have like my role completely down. So being the understudy for Melchior isn't something that like too crazy. Like, I mean, I've jumped into roles with 2 days before the show's open before. So I mean, if anything were to happen, like, I would be there, you know. I'm very good at learning stuff very quickly, but it's nice being there to support the rest of my cast and be there to help out, you know.
I want to ask all of you this question. Mm-hmm. As you think about this show, and in many ways it illustrates the failures of adults supporting teenagers in those most vulnerable years.
Yeah.
Again, so relevant
yeah.
to what we see today. Is that a key theme or message that you want the audience to take away?
I think,
Christine,
when you were asking, you know, how I felt about canceling the show, I was sort of silenced when everything happened on Valentine's Day, and I didn't know what to say. I'm not usually short for words, but I was in that moment. And I finally wrote a post on our, you know, business Facebook page apologizing to the youth of the community on behalf of adults, because how, you know, whatever side of the fence you are, whether it's gun control or mental, you know, safety or anything like that, you know, mental health, I feel like you are obligated as an adult in the community to try to take proactive steps to make sure that your kids are emotionally and physically safe and cared for. And I feel like at a certain point, we as adults do get caught up in our vanity and our bickering back and forth and our arguing that we don't pay attention as much to the kids.
Right. Lee, real quickly,
yes.
You know, I mean, let people know really what to expect. What to expect? How do you sell this to them?
It is a very good show. It's a rock opera, so all the songs as well as the topics, it's very modern. You know, there's a song called The Bitch of Living, and it's like one of my favorite songs to just jam out to, honestly. That's all I'm gonna say. I'm not gonna say any more.
Giorgio,
expect to be shocked.
Just expect that.
All right, and Giorgio, you know, again, it's not just for young people, but you know, enticing adults to come see the show. What would you say?
Well, I mean, the music is insane in the show. Like, coming in, you're gonna love the music right away. It's insane. There's this one song that I think is the best. It's called "Touch Me." I have a beautiful riff in it. I'll let you know that.
Okay. All right. I'll take your word on that. Christine, you added an extra show because a couple sold
out.
Yeah,
we sold out a week and a half before opening, and we had a newspaper article hit yesterday, and we weren't going to have any tickets. So we added a Monday night at 7 p.m., and that's almost gone now, too.
Okay. All right, so we're gonna hear a little bit of the music from the original Broadway production as we go out. Again, Christine Barclay, the owner of artistic director of Barclay Performing Arts. Director of this production, Lee Torelli plays Taya.
Hi, Dad.
And Giorgio Garcia plays Georg, and he's also the understudy for the lead. Lee, Giorgio, Christine, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Break a leg, by
the way.
Thank you. And that's the program for today. Thanks again for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk to you tomorrow.